This is the second day of this June 2012 six-day session, and we'll resume reading from the letters of Chinese Zen Master Yuan Wu, and this is from a book called Zen Letters. These are letters to his students and others. We finished yesterday. When we finished yesterday, we had read this paragraph that begins, "Did Bodhidharma actually bring this teaching when he came from the West?" It's a rhetorical question, of course. His point, Yuan Wu's point, being that if there's any teaching that Bodhidharma brought with him from India to China, it was a no teaching. It was a teaching that no one needs to be taught, actually. We just need to recover, recognize what we've always known in our bones. Linchi, Zen Master Linchi, or Rinzai, was asked about this matter that he had realized and what it was. He said, "When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep." Is that something that anyone needs to bring to someone else? No, it's a matter not of learning, but of unlearning. Getting rid of the stuff that clogs up our minds, that prevents us from being fully awake and attuned to things as they are. He continues, "Once you merge your tracks into the stream of Zen, you spend your days silencing your mind and practicing with your whole being. You realize that this great cause is not obtained from anyone else, but is just a matter of taking up the task boldly and strongly and making constant progress." We just pause here, go back. You spend your days silencing your mind and practicing with your whole being. Of course, when he says silencing your mind and practicing, he's not talking about just the sitting. This would be a very limited kind of practice if Zen practice were just sitting. But it's then the need to extend this mind of stabilized awareness into everything we're doing. That's practice. That's Zen practice. Do not equate Zen practice with sitting. That's just part of it. Silencing your mind is something we can do all the time. Begins with noticing. Noticing what's happening in the mind. Whether our mind is wandering into future or past thoughts or fantasies, or whether it's not. And if it is off in these different tangents, then just to drop those thoughts, which if you're working on a koan mean, you drop the thoughts by just returning the attention to the practice. If it's a non-koan practice, then you just drop the thoughts, leave them alone, become fully present in what you're doing. He goes on, "Day by day you shed your delusions, and day by day you enhance your clarity of mind." Sometimes people get hung up on enlightenment as the be-all and the end-all of practice, and sometimes the result is that they can start to fret about, well, what if I don't come to awakening in this lifetime? Well, you're still, if you're practicing every day, you're still shedding your delusions, enhancing your clarity of mind. Someone, one of the ancients said, referred to Zen as a practice of daily losing. So nothing that we need to acquire in order to reach real, true peace of mind. It's what we need to get rid of, what we need to flush out of the mind, these notions, these stubborn concepts of self, self-concerns, this mental attachments. That's what practice helps free us from. He continues, your potential for enlightened perception is like fine gold that is to be refined hundreds and thousands of times. What is essential for getting out of the dusts, what is basic for helping living creatures, is that you penetrate through freely in all directions and arrive at peace and security, free from doubt, and attain the stage of great potential and great function. Getting out of the dusts. Basically, getting out of one's thoughts. This is a gray, diminished world of thoughts that most people spend their whole lives in. What a bright, vibrant world that opens up when we learn to be present, not in our thoughts. Of course, there are times that we need to think in many different ways. We need to analyze, we plan, we compare. We need to even make judgments at times. This is part of being a human being. But most people spend a hell of a lot of time lost in thoughts when they don't need to be. Roshi Kaplow used to distinguish between thinking and thoughting. Thinking is a marvelous function that we human beings were born with. Thoughting is a pretty useless, aimless, ghost-like activity. It's being caught in this nether world where what we're doing is one thing, and then our mind is somewhere else. You must penetrate through freely in all directions and arrive at peace and security, free from doubt. Doubt is considered one of the five great hindrances in practice. The other four are two pairs, desire and aversion, restlessness and torpor, and then the fifth is doubt. The fifth is considered the most troublesome, because if we don't have faith in the practice and in ourselves, then we lose the ability to practice, or our practice is undermined, at least temporarily. Even with our cravings, we still can practice, actually, sometimes with great fervor, with our aversions, our dislikes. We can also practice with great fervor, and the same with with restlessness, and same with torpor. Well, torpor takes a different kind of working, but doubt undercuts our efforts. So it's important to understand what doubt is. A doubt is a thought. A doubt is a thought. It's not like you're suddenly getting this message from an oracle. Oh, here I believe that I could do this. Oh, no. It's just a thought. Don't pay any attention to it. You know, easier said than done. And when one is in the grip of a doubt, it can be pretty compelling. But if you can find a way to stay in the game, persevere, then when you emerge on the other side of the doubt, then you see that it's just another form of dust in the mind. He continues, "This work is located precisely in your own inner actions. It is just a matter of being in the midst of the interplay of the myriad causal conditions every day, in the confusion of the red dusts, amid favorable and adverse circumstances and gain and loss, appearing and disappearing in their midst without being affected and turned around by them, but on the contrary, being able to transform them and turn them around." Well, when he says here, this work is located precisely in your own inner actions, I guess what he means by that is it's your own mind and your own intentions. That it's, in other words, that it's not, we are not determined, our abilities, our practice, our experience of reality is not determined by circumstances as so much as by the mind. We know that some people can be in adverse circumstances, be very stressed out. Other people can be in the same circumstances and not have the same stress. Some people can suffer losses, and they're not brought down as far as others who suffer the same kind of losses. It's all in the mind, and how we are using or misusing our minds that determines these things. And when he says, "It is just a matter of being in the midst of the interplay of the myriad causal conditions every day, the confusion of the red dust," he's really saying, I mean, since we're all in the myriad, the interplay of the myriad causal conditions every day, it's really a warning, an implicit warning, not to try to escape life with all of its stressors, not to think that that's the answer. If you could just retire into the mountains or the desert or the forest, then everything would be fine. Say no. Engage with life. But practice. Use it to practice the sitting and moving practice. And then we can acquire the ability to not lose our footing in these circumstances, these trying circumstances. That is, as he says, we're not turned around by them, but on the contrary, we turn them around. We transform challenging circumstances into opportunities. I think of the words of great Chinese master Zhao Zhou, also known by his Japanese name Joshu, who said, "Most people are used by the 24 hours. I use the 24 hours." you know, when you translate it that way with that strong I, it sounds egotistical. I think I'm sure that in the original Chinese that didn't have that I, but rather in some way he was distinguishing between the ordinary person, the way the ordinary person always feels, but the way so many people these days especially feel used by the 24 hours, feel oppressed by time and losing time and racing against time, as compared to those who can use those 24 hours freely, consciously, except rather than feeling bound by time. He goes on, when you are leaping with life and water cannot wet you, this is your own measure of power. Water cannot wet you. Well, it just follows from what he was just saying. We're not turned around by circumstances, but we turn them around. It's really, I think he's talking here, water cannot wet you, about detachment. Detachment is a wonderful, wonderful word, not to mention the quality to develop through practice. I think it's sometimes misunderstood. It can sound cold and remote, and it's not to be confused with what might be called intellectual detachment, where you intellectualize things and step back from people and circumstances. Buddhist detachment means freedom. Not always reacting to things, but being able to maintain a presence of mind and see things in their proper proportion. Seeing things with dispassionately. Without bias, without egoistic bias. That's really what detachment means. It's one of the most amazing qualities that humans have in their nature. And it's one of the many byproducts of practice. We don't have to, I don't have to go about making a project out of being detached. It comes from daily practice. We don't take things so seriously. We don't take ourselves so seriously. That's detachment. It was G.K. Chesterton, the British essayist, who said the reason that angels can fly is because they don't take themselves, is because they take themselves so lightly. Whereas the ordinary person is always personalizing things, taking things personally. A remark, a misstep on someone else's part, maybe someone bumps into them, it becomes personal. There's a wonderful story that the Buddha tells about an analogy he uses of someone in a boat who suddenly feels another boat collide with him, and he turns around in a fury at that person who is so careless, and he sees that there's no one in the boat. It's just a boat adrift on the water. What happens to his anger at that moment? For most people, it would be completely gone. The ultimate detachment comes from seeing the insubstantiality of self and other, seeing through this illusion of ego, then we can more easily avoid reacting to people, even when they are angry. We have enough emotional distance that we're not caught in it. We can perhaps see that this is their issue. They're caught up in it. We don't have to react to their problem. Mean people are suffering. That goes a long way toward diffusing conflict and stress. That's where I mentioned yesterday in Taisho about getting beyond self-talk, self-reminders, but until we're past them, then they can be useful. They can be what we call in Buddhism expedient means. And if we have, if there's someone who is really bothering us and because of their stupidity or anger or hostility, it can help. If we don't help us avoid reacting negatively, if we can learn, if we can catch ourselves as we're about to react and just remember that meanness in the person is their suffering. They don't have to take it personally. That's them suffering. Why join with them in their suffering? Why create our own in our reactions to them? We left off with this phrase, water cannot wet you. He goes on, you reach an empty, solidified silence, but there is no duality between emptiness and form or between silence and noise. You equalize all sorts of wondrous sayings and perilous devices and absolute perceptions. Ultimately, there is no gain or loss, and it is all your own to use. He's talking here. He's referring to a very advanced, a very lofty state of development. Where he begins by saying, no duality between emptiness and form. Well, we chant this every day in Sesshin, in the Prajnaparamita. Form here is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. The problem is, as soon as we use a word for each of those concepts, form and emptiness, then it's very difficult, until awakening, it's very difficult to see that they're not two, this what we call form and what we call emptiness, what we call sound and what we call silence. Through words we are deceived into dividing the indivisible. Me, you, us, them. Frank, Jennifer, Republicans, Democrats. It's Zazen is a way to access this realm that is underneath all of these divisions, these distinctions. The more we can access that realm of no mind, no separation, no division, the more we will be able to move through our busy lives without water wetting us. Ultimately, there is no gain or loss. There's another conceptual division that is imposed on reality by our discursive minds. When you go on grinding and polishing like this for a long time, you are liberated right in the midst of birth and death, and you look upon the world's useless reputation and ruinous profit as mere dust in the wind, as a dream, as a magical apparition, as an optical illusion. Set free, you pass through the world. Isn't this what it means to be a great sage who has emerged from the dusts of sensory attachments? I love this rich, vivid language of his for practice, grinding and polishing. When he says you're liberated right in the midst of birth and death, one way to understand birth and death, we use this phrase a lot in Zen, one way to understand that phrase, birth and death, is the world of change, the world of dualities, world of samsara, of desire and disappointment and success and failure. Don't take it literally that it just means, you know, when you're on your deathbed and so forth. Here's another letter, and he starts by quoting Zhao Zhou, Zhoshu. During my 30 years in the South, the only times I mixed mundane concerns into my mental activity were during the morning and noon meals. Now, I have to say I don't understand that sentence, that claim by Zhao Zhou, or let's say a report, that report of Zhao Zhou's. The only time I mixed mundane concerns into my mental activity. What does he mean by mundane concerns? That's what trips me up. Certainly he's not saying the only time I mixed thoughts into my mental activity. That's just impossible to swallow that. For 30 years he never had any thoughts except during the morning and noon meals, and why then? Anyway, let's go on. From this we should realize that in carrying out this matter, the ancient worthies did not take it as a casual thing. On the contrary, they took it seriously and treated it with respect. That's how they persevered in their practice and attained insight. That's how they reached thoroughgoing clarity and never fell into empty vanity in action or speech. Thus they managed to unify worldly phenomena and enlighten truth. Certainly that we can understand. They managed to unify worldly phenomena and enlighten truth. But the world of phenomena, which is the world of the senses, everything we know through our five senses and the sixth, the intellect or thinking, that that world is not separate from the world of enlightenment. They're not two. To construe them as separate worlds is just a notion, a concept in the mind. And this matter is one that they took, they're referring to the ancient worthies, they took it seriously and treated it with respect. If ever there's a time when we can do this, it's in Sesshin. We don't have the ordinary distractions of our busy lives. We don't have the ordinary responsibilities of our busy lives. Everything is simplified in Sesshin. And to treat this opportunity with respect is to use every moment to make the effort to not lapse into thoughts. And when we notice that we are lapsing into thoughts, which inevitably we do over and over again, then respect means then not lingering there, not lingering in these thoughts and continuing to chew on them for even a little while longer, but to return the mind directly to our practice. This also means self-respect. This is how we work when we respect our true self, our Buddha nature. Here's another phrase. They never fell into empty vanity in action or speech or thought. Empty vanity in action, speech, or thought means self-concern. He goes on, in the present time, those who want to draw near to reality must boldly mobilize their energies and transform what is within them. You must not cling to wrong knowledge and wrong views. You must not mix poison into your food. You must be uniformly pure and true and clean and wondrously illuminated to step directly into the scenery of the fundamental ground and reach the peaceful and secure stage of great liberation. This phrase, you must not mix poison into your food. One way to understand that is, of course, he's not referring to food literally, but maybe daily activities as spiritual sustenance. And mixing poison into our daily activities is dwelling in our thoughts, clinging to thoughts. Then you stand aloof and alone so that wind cannot blow in and water cannot wet you. The true essence becomes manifest, and in your daily activities you have a measure of power. As you hear sounds and see forms, you don't give rise to grasping or rejecting. With every move, you have a road to get out on. That is, you never feel blocked or stuck. These first sentence, then you stand aloof and alone. I don't know about that choice of the word aloof as a translation for whatever the Chinese was. I think what it really what the original must have meant is you stand detached or dispassionate, but certainly not disengaged and not indifferent. That's the last thing that we ever want to be, is indifferent because of being disengaged from things. But alone, now that's a rich word. Alone. No other. No separation. Above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world-honored one. This is samadhi. And then here, this next letter, Yuan Wu, is talking about the great Da Wei, one of the most famous of the Chinese masters of his era, the Song Dynasty. He refers to him here as Gao, the patch-robed one. And then it's the translator who tells us that he's referring to Da Wei, one of Yuan Wu's most illustrious successors. Gao, the patch-robed one, with his fearless and sharp nature, traveled all over the country visiting the expert craftsmen of the Zen school. The former prime minister and Zen master Zhang Wujin came to know of him and respected him deeply as a vessel of the teaching. Since Gao had an extraordinary spirit, he was not content to follow small understanding. After demonstrating his sincerity, he became one of my associates. We reached accord at a single word, and he shed the halter that had hitherto bridled him. He's talking, of course, referring to his enlightenment. Though he had still not reached total comprehension, he was a robust and lively fellow whom nobody could suppress or rein in. I'll continue here. He goes on, when we trace back where this came from, this strong spirit, after all, it was due to Master Wu Jin inspiring him. Subsequently, Gao braved the freezing cold and came for a while to visit me at Xianping. When he came to announce his departure, he asked for some words of teaching, which I accordingly gave him. This is what I told him. Those who wear the patched robe of a Zen monk should be completely serious about taking death and rebirth as their business. You should work to melt away the obstructions caused by conditioned knowledge and views and interpretive understanding, and penetrate through to a realization of the great causal condition communicated and bequeathed by the Buddhas and ancestral teachers. Don't covet name and fame. Step back and turn to reality until your practical understanding and virtue are fully actualized. And then Yuanwu continues in his words of advice to Dawei. When there is real attainment, the more you try to hide it, the more it cannot be concealed. All the sages and the devas and nagas will try to push a person of real attainment forward, especially after years of cultivation and refinement. Wait until you are like a bell sounding when struck, or a valley returning an echo. Wait until you are like pure gold coming forth from a forge where it has been smelted and refined 10,000 times so that it will not change in 10,000 generations, so that it is 10,000 years in a single moment. When the grip of transcendence is in your hand, when the grasses bend down as the wind blows, then won't you be expansive and generous with resources to spare? Remember, what is important in practice is perseverance and consistency. With that, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.